Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we continue our month-long series on the American Civil War by looking at one of the most successful but controversial generals in the Union Army, Ulysses S. Grant. Our guest is Grant biographer Gene Edward Smith. We'll also get historian Michael Fellman's take on Grant's primary opponent, the equally highly regarded military leader Robert E. Lee. But before we get to those topics, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. This week in history, on March 11, 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt signed into effect the Lend-Lease Act, originally suggested by British Prime Minister Winston Churchill as a system of providing war materiel, foodstuffs, and clothing to a British nation ravaged by German bombs and crippled by bankruptcy. Lend-Lease gave the president the power to aid any nation whose defense was deemed vital to that of the United States through the transfer of defense materiel, services, and intelligence information. Lend-Lease could not have arrived on the international scene at a more critical moment. France had fallen to Hitler's army, Britain was being pounded by the Blitz, and German armies were poised to strike at the Soviet Union. But the legislative act would draw the United States closer to war, as every dollar of aid bound the fates of the fighting allies and the non-belligerent America even closer together. By the end of World War II, Congress appropriated nearly $50 billion to more than 40 countries, including the Soviet Union and China. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a new exhibit displaying slide rules, crystal-clear plastic protractors, and disposable graph paper has opened at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. Designed to trace the evolution of math teaching in America's schools, the exhibit divides math history in America into different time periods. The first, spanning 1800 to 1860, is represented by the prominent display of the blackboard and white chalk. Disposable graph paper points to the increasing sophistication and abstraction of math after the Civil War. Also displayed are several mathematical games developed in the 1950s that reveal an American school system intent on keeping its students competitive with the Russians, an enemy in a Cold War that was waged even in the classroom. The French government has unveiled plans to build a memorial to French resistance fighters at the site of the only German concentration camp in France during the Second World War. By 2004, Struthof, the camp where an estimated 22,000 of the French resistance died of starvation, torture, and illness, will house a permanent exhibition of photographs, historical documents, and films that chronicle the experience of 45,000 resistance fighters who were detained in the camp between 1941 and 1944. This is Talking History. He wasn't Lincoln's first choice, but he may have been his best. Ulysses Grant is often credited with winning the war for the Union, but his military leadership, as well as his life before and after the Civil War, even as president, are not without controversy. Here to explore the life of this enigmatic Civil War hero is Talking History's Fred Nielsen and his guest, Gene Edward Smith.
Ulysses S. Grant is a paradoxical figure. On the eve of the Civil War, he was judged by many to be a failure. Yet this failure would soon rise to command an army that would, with its victories, demolish slavery and save the Union. A national hero, Grant would be elected twice to the presidency, the only man in the half century between Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson elected to consecutive terms. His memoirs of the Civil War are a literary classic. Here to discuss Ulysses S. Grant, the man, the general, and the president, is Gene Edward Smith, a professor of political science at Marshall University, and the author of a biography, Grant. The book was recognized by the New York Times as one of the most distinguished books of the year 2001. Professor Smith, welcome.
Thank you.
A graduate of West Point, Grant served in the Mexican War in 1846 and 1847. What was his experience and what did he work?
Grant served as a lieutenant in the 4th Infantry, and I think he learned the responsibility of command. It was a small army, and he was able to watch at close quarters both General Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott, who were incredibly able. I think two other things that I might add. He He also learned the importance of momentum. Both Taylor and Scott kept at the Mexican army as intensely as they could, and Grant learned from that it was best to always stay on the offensive. Lastly, I think he learned that an army could live off the land, as General Scott did when he cut off from his supply line at Veracruz and moved on Mexico City. Grant repeated that same maneuver at Vicksburg. He cut off from his supply line at Memphis, moved south of Vicksburg, crossed the Mississippi, and hit Vicksburg from the east. That was a lesson that he learned from Scott's campaign.
For much of the decade after the Mexican War, that is to say, for much of Grant seemed to be a failure, and surely no one could have then predicted the military and political cess that lay ahead for him.
Well, that's certainly true. If you can imagine a man who was in his mid-30s working as a clerk in the family leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, when Beauregard fired on Fort Sumter, and no one could possibly conceive that 4 years later he would be general-in-chief of the armies of the United States.
Grant believed that Southern secession, when it comes in 1860 and 1861 of the Mexican War, what did he see as the connection between the two?
Slavery. He thought that the Mexican War was an outgrowth of admitting Texas to the Union as a slave state, and that the slave interests in the United States, the slave states, wanted to add additional territory where slavery could flourish, and northern Mexico served that purpose.
When Fort Sumter is finally fired on in April of 61 and the Civil War begins, Grant is one of many Americans to answer the call quickly. He organizes troops and hopes for a command. Why was Grant fighting? What did he see as his cause in this conflict?
Preservation of the Union. Preservation of the Union. Don't forget, the South, those who attempted to secede were rebels. This was treason, and Grant was fighting to preserve the Union.
Does his sense of the cause change at all as the war progresses?
It did. Preservation of the Union always remained paramount, but Grant was ambivalent towards slavery when the war began. It was only, I think, through the influence of President Lincoln that Grant, by 1863, had come to recognize that slavery as an institution could not survive the war, and he became as dedicated as the president to the abolition of slavery.
Grant, for a very long time, has had a reputation as a heavy drinker. There's a story, of course, about Lincoln wanting to give the same liquor to his other generals that Grant supposedly was drinking.
Quite true.
Is that reputation a deserved one or not?
Yes and no. In the early 1850s, he was a captain assigned to the West Coast, Fort Humboldt in California. His wife and family were back east, and he became terribly morose at an isolated army post in the far west, and he drank more than he could handle. Grant was a small man. His metabolism was such that he couldn't accommodate much liquor, and he drank to excess at that time. In fact, he was discovered by his commanding officer, inebriated at Paycall, and his commander, Colonel Buchanan, gave him the option of resigning or facing a court-martial. And in 1854, Grant resigned very suddenly from the army because of that. Army, and when he was back home with his wife, and during the war, and as president, Grant drank very little, and he was never accused. No one ever saw him inebriated after that experience in 1854.
What kind of general was he?
Grant was a muddy boots general. He believed in seeing things for himself, as Zachary Taylor did. In fact, I think he modeled himself on old Rough and Ready, Zachary Taylor. Meade said much the same about Grant. He was plain-spoken, and he dressed very plainly. I got that from Taylor, too. He often sometimes appeared in civilian clothes, never wore full-dress uniform in the field. And his usual field uniform was simply that of an army private with stars pinned on the shoulders. So Grant was a general who observed things very closely for himself. His staff throughout the war was minimal. As general-in-chief of the armies of the United States, his staff amounted to 16 people. It's incredible when you think about it.
Grant and Lee's armies fight it out at the end of the Civil War. There's a paradox here in a way. Grant wins the war, and yet for many years Lee seems to have had the superior military reputation. That seems to be changing in recent years. And I wonder, what accounts for the shift in the scholarly reputations of Lee and Grant?
Well, I think initially much of the history of the period was written by Southern historians, Lost Cause historians, who glorified Lee as emblematic of Southern virtue, so as a romantic attachment to the Lost Cause, and Grant was seen as a very ordinary American in contrast to Lee, indistinguishable in a crowd, someone whose appearance was so very ordinary that no one could conceive that he had an incredibly fine mind and was a brilliant strategist and tactician. And I think that feeling endured for many, many years. It's changing now because I think of the recognition that the South was fighting for the maintenance of slavery, that these were rebels, traitors to the United States. They wanted to break up the Union. I think that recognition has dawned most particularly in the last 20 years. And I think with the black of equal rights for African Americans, Grant's reputation has undergone significant revision because Grant, next to Lincoln, fought for black equality harder than anyone else.
At Appomattox, Grant's goal, again, very much like Lincoln's, was reconciliation between former enemies, not retribution. And after Lincoln's assassination, you note in your book that it was Grant's word alone that stood between. I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit. Why was reconciliation so important to Grant, and what did he do particularly to save Lee?
Grant wanted to bring the Union back together, just as Lincoln did, and he shared Lincoln's view. And of his own accord at Appomattox, he had added a statement, which he wrote out in longhand, that the officers and men who surrendered and went home would not be disturbed again by the United States so long as they observed the laws in place where they resided. In effect, Grant pardoned all of the Army of Virginia, Northern Virginia, with that stroke of the pen. And after the war, President Johnson and his administration sought to try General Lee and General Longstreet and General Johnston for treason, which they had in fact committed, and all three were indicted by federal grand jury in Norfolk for treason. Lee wrote to Grant, President Johnson, and told him that under the terms of surrender, the officers could not be tried for treason, and really forced Johnson to back down. And so it was Grant himself who intervened on behalf of Lee and Johnson and Longstreet to have the federal charges of treason quashed. That went a long way toward rebuilding the nation, and ameliorating the animosity that existed. And Grant was highly regarded for that in the years immediately following the Civil War.
We've talked about Grant's reputation as a military leader and how it's been rising in recent years. It strikes me that there's a kind of schizophrenic quality to his place in history. Being hailed increasingly as a military leader, he remains in many people's minds a terrible president when he was elected in 1868 and then reelected in 1872. In fact, among the worst presidents in history. Is that a fair assessment?
No, absolutely not. And it's interesting you mention that because that was exactly my appreciation when I began to write about Grant 5 or 6 years ago. And the fact is that Grant's presidency was outstanding. In the first place, Grant served for 8 years. The nation had been divided by civil war and by the incredible Johnson administration, and it was Grant who provided stability, a stoic, rock-like presence in the White House that really restored confidence throughout America. More importantly, though, I think, are the specific achievements of the Grant administration. Grant ended the animosity that had festered with Great Britain because of the Alabama claims during the Civil War, and really, really going back to the Revolution in the War of 1812. And with the Treaty of Washington in 1873, placed American-British relations on the level of harmony that have existed since then. He kept the United States out of war with Spain over Cuba. He vetoed an inflation bill that would have inflated American currency and made economic recovery almost impossible. And as a result, by the end of the century, the American dollar was revered as the most stable medium of exchange in the world. I don't think many people recognize that Grant really signed the first Civil Service Act, attempting to end the spoils system. Congress wouldn't renew it, but Grant had taken the lead in establishing a federal civil service. Similarly, in the terms of Native Americans, Grant was elected president, much like Eisenhower in 1950, who was going to end the war in Korea. Many thought Grant was going to annihilate the Plains Indians just as he had defeated the rebel armies. Grant always had a fond place for Native Americans and simply ended the war in the West and initiated what's been called Grant's peace policy to integrate Native Americans into American society. Grant named the first Native American to be chairman of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He established a national park system. Yellowstone was created during Grant's administration at Grant's strong urging. And I think lastly, maybe most importantly, he presided over the Hayes-Tilden dispute of the election of 1876. Looking at Bush-Gore, we can appreciate that all the more, perhaps, because it was Grant who devised the method for settling the dispute, who rammed it through a reluctant Republican Senate, and who had the confidence of both parties to do so. So he presided over that very difficult transition, in many ways much more difficult than Bush-Gore in 2000. I guess, just lastly, if I might just make one final point. Thomas Nashe, the great cartoonist, whose pictures of the Tweed Gang in New York really helped to bring the Tweed Gang down, adored Grant, and his cartoons of Grant really put it in the perspective with which Grant was respected at the time.
You're right that Grant is one of the most complex figures in American history, and you just describe him as an enigma, as a paradox, and as a challenge for a biographer as you try to reconcile the disparities in his status and reputation. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more. What is it that makes him seem enigmatic and paradoxical, and particularly what were the challenges for you as you tried to wrestle with those aspects of his character?
Well, I think the combination of failure and success. Grant failed miserably in the 1850s after he left the Army. He tried to make a living at farming. He failed. He tried to make a living collecting rents. He failed. He tried to make a living as a businessman in St. Louis. He failed. He was an incredible financial failure. And yet, once the war began, his military genius had an opportunity to express itself. After he left the presidency, revered by the nation, the nation's leading citizen, on Wall Street, firm of Grant and Ward. Ward was a crook and a charlatan and had been kiting the firm's assets. The firm went bankrupt. Grant was left penniless. He was left penniless, and a month later discovered that he had cancer of the throat. There were no pensions in those days. His family would have been unprovided for. And in the face of that adversity, penniless, with no source of income, Grant wrote the memoirs which you mentioned in the introduction, which are regarded as the finest military memoirs ever written, and one of the great books of the English language. So it's a combination of failure and success, extreme failure and extraordinary success, that make Grant a paradox.
Well, Professor Smith, perhaps we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you very much.
I've been visiting with Gene Edward Smith, the author of a biography simply entitled Grant.
Anyone who attempts to assess Ulysses Grant's military success in the American Civil War needs to take into consideration the efforts of his primary opponent, Robert E. Lee. Here to help us with that assessment is Michael Fellman, professor of history at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Be careful not to affect the monarch too much. Keep yourself simple, good, pure, serious, and unassuming. Life is short, and this earthly existence has but a single fruit to yield, holiness within and selfless action without. Robert E. Lee, every inch the Virginia aristocrat, had always tried to measure his actions with these stoic words of the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius. During the first year of the Civil War, when he had suffered a string of reverses, Lee remained both modest and duty-bound. But then, something happened. Given command of the Army of Northern Virginia in June 1862 only because its commander had suffered grave wounds, Lee stopped George McClellan's attacking forces a scant 12 miles from Richmond, and then threw them back. During the subsequent year, Lee's army repulsed the Yankees in battle after battle. While it did, Lee's stoic calm and spiritual resignation receded as anger and pride emerged. A British journalist noted, "No man who saw his flashing eyes and sternly set lips is ever likely to forget them, the light of battle flaming in his eyes." Lee also became openly contemptuous of his enemies, calling one a miscreant, and commenting after smashing the Union at Fredericksburg in December 1862, "They came as they went, in the night. They suffered heavily as far as the battle went, but it did not go far enough to satisfy me." On May 2, 1863, at Chancellorsville, a farmer guided Stonewall Jackson's corps via a hidden road onto the Yankee flank, leading to a major victory. Afterwards, Lee concluded with more pride and overconfidence than accuracy, "Attacking largely superior numbers and strongly entrenched positions, the heroic courage of my men overcame every natural obstacle." With this audacious mindset, it was on to Gettysburg, where Lee anticipated a climactic victory. For 3 days, as if no one were in charge, brave. No historian has ever discerned the exact reasons. Lee's commanding intelligence failed in the face of an enemy for once better organized than he. Afterwards, Lee's humility flooded back, even though he blamed others for his defeat more than himself. He would struggle on with stoic resignation for only 2 more horrific years. But during his time of miraculous victories, he had acted upon a previously unexpressed martial passion, and had brought himself and his army to the brink of victory, but then into the depths of defeat.
You've been listening to Michael Fellman, author of The Making of Robert E. Lee, and this is Talking History.
The bells were ringing tonight, they drove old Dixie down, and all the people were singing, they went, na 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 na.
When it comes to great Civil War sites, certain names come readily to mind: Gettysburg, Manassas, Fredericksburg, and Chancellorsville. But, though less well-known, there were many others of importance, and here to tell you about some of them, as our Sites of the Week, is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Petersburg doesn't usually make the list of great Civil War sites, but it definitely should not be overlooked. This railway hub south of Richmond, Virginia, was the scene of a bitter standoff between Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee. In fact, it occupied the last 10 months of the Civil War. But Point City, about 10 miles, meets the Appomattox River. City Point was the supply depot for the Union forces besieging Petersburg from June of 1864 until the following April. It was here that a type of torpedo was smuggled aboard and destroyed an ammunitions barge. A modest cabin that's been reconstructed on the lawn served as Grant's headquarters, and a weekend walking tour called Civil War Weekend may be one of the best ways to see the little-known or forgotten sites and to hear in the first person what happened at each of the sites. For more information on the Civil War Weekend tours, visit their website at civilwarweekend.com.
And finally, looking ahead to upcoming events of historical interest, Faced with continuing loss of their lands and the decline of hunting and fishing in the 19th century, the Iroquois nations of New York State and Canada came up with a successful survival strategy. They would sell tourists the fancy beadwork they had long done for themselves, and so a flourishing cottage industry was born. Moccasins, bags, pincushions, needle cases, jewelry, clothes, and hanging baskets were stitched with tiny glass beads by women using tribal themes, but also adapting their work to the taste of their buyers. 300 of the surviving pieces of this trade have been gathered in Across Borders, Beadwork and Iroquois Life at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in New York City. The principal message of this exhibit is that although intended for sale on the open market, the items reflected a vital design sense and extraordinary handcraft that were part of a centuries-old tradition. Across Borders will be at the Museum of the American Indian until May 19th. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week when we'll continue our month-long series on the American Civil War. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University, the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Lebeau. We are free.